You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truth Without Radio. Today's date is Friday the 13th of July 2018 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAryan.com. My gosh, we do seem to be having a lot of these Friday the 13th. Unlucky for Theresa May, I hope, but not so unlucky for us. We have managed to get hold of Dennis, although we did have a few technical problems at the beginning. Dennis, how are you doing today?
Well, I'm still recovering from Croatia making the World Cup final. Sorry, England fans. Which probably means all the electrics have all gone to cock.
I thought you'd be enjoying that one. I mean, you really couldn't lose there, could you?
Well, try to say that, England fans.
Well, I was going to say, who do you support when it comes down to England and Croatia?
You can't have two masters, Sven.
Well, either way, I'm sure you must have been pleased with the outcome.
Oh, over the moon.
Anyway, I'm pleased with the outcome tonight.
Then we're all the guy.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what. Yeah, you know, good luck to Croatia. Anyway, I do hope they succeed. Where are they against? The French, isn't it? Defeating playing a game against the French, aren't they? Against the Frogs?
Yeah, the French on Sunday, yeah. You know what I think about Masons.
Definitely want to see Croatia defeat them anyway.
Definitely.
Well, anyway, as I say, I'm really pleased tonight. I've had a chance to see episode 15, the preview of episode 15, and it really does not disappoint. It's, quite an eye-opener at the end, quite a big reveal that I wasn't expecting, that we'll probably get into tonight. Yeah, did you have any idea about that before until recently, Dennis? Or is that something you've known about for a while, or did you just uncover it?
About a month ago. So I've just had it on the shelf, you know, ready to make to use of.
Well, it's exciting stuff anyway, and we'll get to that later on. I'm just trying to get up our notes here. As I say, we were all in a bit of a rush because we were having problems getting Dennis connected. But yeah, I mean, the part 15 is mainly dealing with Stalin and the threat that Europe faces from Bolshevism. And what we've got here, we've got the written parts of it, and we can go through that, and then maybe we can expand on it. Because obviously it just flashes past you in a few seconds when you're actually watching it on the video, and there's quite a lot that we can go into with it, isn't there, really?
Yeah, well, it was only rough, so, you know, there will be some alterations to it, but yeah, I think people will be surprised.
Definitely. Well, as I say, it starts with a title, The Threat Europe Faced from Bolshevism, and then straight after that we have Goebbels giving a speech, and he's just sort of outlining what's happening, what the Bolsheviks are up to. And one of the things that he lists is the rape of nuns, specifically the rape of nuns and the attacks on the church. And then he says that Hitler is the protector of the culture of mankind and civilization against the forces of the world revolution, which is, you know, that's exactly what was going on. Goebbels was telling his people the truth about the forces that they were fighting against, and this is what was happening at this time, was this world revolution. Do you want to talk a bit more about sort of setting the scene of what was happening at this time before we really start getting into it, Dennis?
Well, really, I put that part up because it really confirms everything what I've been saying since the documentary started. I've always said that Hitler was the... Many people, you know, regarded him as the only person who could stop communism, and that even spread to people back in America like Ford. And Goebbels is obviously making the point that Bolshevism, he actually says before that, he mentions that it's a Jewish invention led by Jews, which is exactly what Bolshevism was. And it did, from what he'd heard about the massacred priests and nuns and whatever, disgusted him and rightly so. And then he turned to announce that Hitler was a true knight, someone with a strong hand who's going to stand up to this attempted invasion, probably coming sooner than they think. So it just covered everything that I've been saying, which is always nice.
That's good. When you find a speech by one of the leading members of the National Socialist Democratic Workers' Party or German Workers' Party, when you actually hear them saying that, you know, exactly the same as you, using the same language as you, that just confirms everything that we're saying, doesn't it?
Exactly, yeah. It was a good find, actually. I found that a couple of weeks ago as well, and I knew I'd be using it at some point. But yeah, and obviously when talking about Stalin being a, you know, obviously it doesn't take a genius to work out that the US bankers had won the US Revolution, the Russian Revolution, what they funded, and consequently, you know, they were the true masters of the Soviet Union, which has been hidden from us through the history books again. So consequently, you know, once you realise that, you know, a lot of things do open up again, which I've said before.
So you think Stalin was, you know, he'd realised this at some point, and that's why he sort of turned on his masters, and that's why they went after the Soviet Union after the war?
Correct.
Because he was running things instead of the banks. I know. That's an interesting theory. I believe there is a book out that makes Stalin out to be the good guy. I haven't actually read it. But,
I can never call him a good guy. He killed 66 million Christians. I can never call him a good guy.
Yeah. Maybe that's the wrong terminology to use, but just to say that our actual idea of what he is, it's actually different to how it was. And there are bits and pieces that we're not actually aware of. It's not all
dried. This is why I think that they try and hide the fact. I mean, you know, everything about his lifestyle was Jewish. He could speak Yiddish, he had two Jewish wives, he's Jewish kids. So he got up every morning and had breakfast. He sat down at a Jewish breakfast table. He certainly worked for the Jews. And I know one or two people say he weren't a Freemason, but I find that now impossible. Because the more I look at it, when I see Roosevelt and I see Churchill, I don't think you can be sat next to him unless you're a Freemason. I really, truly believe that. And plus, I've got the picture of him there. Well, this is all going on of him with the hidden hand. He's had a statue, which I first found on the cover of a book a while back, but I found the actual statue now of him with his, just like Napoleon, hidden hand. It doesn't get more Masonic.
You could say, though, that he did have a damaged arm. That's one of the reasons something happened.
Some film footage in The Great Story Never Told, when he came out of a building, saw the camera, put his hand in.
Yeah, he had something wrong with his arm. So I was just looking up some information on him today. And, you know, a lot of people were saying, well, his surname is Djugashvili, and that means son of a Jew.
Yeah, yeah.
But Djuga is steel in Russian. But the same information that I've got, it alleges that his mother was actually Jewish, and she was the son of a cobbler in the village.
Yeah.
And the cobbler was actually a Jew. So his mother was Jewish, not his father, because people tend to say that his father was Jewish. And then, of course, he had his two Jewish wives, as you say. And there's this allegation of anti-Semitism later on in the 50s. And, you know, the press was saying the Soviet Union are having all these anti-Semitic purges. But what it really was just him getting rid of the leaders that weren't loyal to him, and they just happened to be Jews, because they were replaced with other Jews. It was just the world's press that was saying that it was anti-Semitic. You know, there were so many Jews in the Soviet Union that I think you had a power struggle between them. At some point, you had Zionist Jews and communist ones, really. All right, well, let's get into the wording in chapter 15. And it starts and it says, the Bolsheviks were the Masonic avant-garde of the armies of Freemasonry. And that word, avant-garde, it comes from the French. It means advance guard or vanguard, literally foreguard. It's people or works that are experimental, radical, or unorthodox with respect to art, culture, or society. And I think it's really E. Michael Jones that's popularized this in this in this context. Because he was saying that the Black Lives Matter were the avant-garde, and now it's the homosexuals are the avant-garde
for
the Bolsheviks.
That's right.
But back then, it was the Bolsheviks. They were the Masonic avant-garde. They were the ones driving things. They were the radicals at the time.
And all the Western leaders knew about them for the admissions of what went on in Poland in 1920. In fact, every country they went in, they raped and pillaged.
Well, they knew about it before then, didn't they? Well, 1920, as you say. I mean, there was British intelligence reports. Winston Churchill wrote
That's
about
right.
it back then. And then
That's
suddenly
right.
he's working with them.
Coming by the back door.
Suddenly he's working with them years later. Well, going back to the wording, the huge Red Army was originally built up by the Freemason Trotsky and funded by the US bankers. In 1941, Stalin had the world's largest military perched on the borders of Europe, which Western historians have continually maintained was just there for defensive reasons. So where are the records of that found, Dennis, and the proof that it was offensive?
Well, it's found in Viktor Sukhov's book, which the title escapes me at the moment, Icebreaker. And also in Communism by the Back Door, I named the officer that signed the actual treaty. When they opened the archives and the Soviet Union fell, it names the officer who signed the actual signature to say that the invasion will be on such a day. So it's been denied in the West. I mean, Wikipedia messed around with it, saying it's just a conspiracy. But apparently in Eastern Europe, it's been well known.
Yeah, I think it was in the archives, isn't it? I mean, after 50 years or whatever, then the archives get opened up. And I believe it was in there.
Soviet Union fell, didn't it? So there was nobody around to stop them opening them.
Yeah, it was that as well. But I imagine they've still got stuff that's hidden. I mean, over here in Britain, they have 50 years and 75 years. I mean, there's stuff about the JFK killing that still hasn't been opened.
Yeah, well, don't always open them, do they? Even when they've got time on it, yeah.
Well, with this Holler hoax and this law that you're not allowed to question it, I mean, it's not beyond the realms of possibility that they could just do that about other incidents in history and say, well, you're not allowed to question it. We're not going to give you the records.
Yeah.
Of what actually went on.
Yeah.
You know, it sets that precedent.
I saw someone write, so they said, actually, denial, asking to investigate is not actually denial, but they don't even let you investigate.
No, you're not even allowed to look too closely at it. You've just got to take their word for it. Mm. Well, this military...
Exactly. Well, not just their word, the Bolsheviks, because they said it happened first at Auschwitz.
Well, yeah, that's just it. Hardly trustworthy people to believe. I mean, they're just a bunch of gangsters, weren't they? I mean, Stalin was a bank robber.
That was his career, yeah.
Yeah, bank robber. You've got a government made up of bank robbers and gangsters. I guess we still have today, but they're a little bit more...
And then they all moved to America after Warfell, though.
Yeah, they're a little bit more clever about it now, a little bit more subtle about it, but still the same thing, bank robbers.
Same thing, yeah.
Well, this military for defence was built up of 30 armies, seven of which included many thousands of men who had been released from concentration camps to fight in return for their freedom. But I think there were other incentives as well, weren't there, such as threats to the family and, you know, they'd be shot.
Yeah, there was, actually, yeah. Yeah, the usual Stalin treatment, isn't it, really?
Wasn't there a series of directives and each one got worse than the last?
Well, if a soldier got captured as a prisoner of war, for instance, Stalin didn't recognise any prisoners of war. So when the Russians went into the camps to liberate, inverted commas, they weren't actually liberated, they were sent to the Gulag. Even that, there's a piece in The Great Story Never Told where Hitler actually praises the defender, the Soviet defenders of a particular place, and they were sent to the camps, you know, but they were actually heroes for the Russians, if you like, because they'd lasted so long, and they lasted that long, even Hitler praised them. But as soon as the war was over, they were sent to the Gulag, the lot of them.
No honour whatsoever. No honour at all.
No.
Well, they were known as the Black Divisions because many still wore their black gulag uniforms. Also on standby were 1 million paratroopers who are trained to assault, not defend. And the marked BT tank.
Yeah, don't defend, are they?
Well, yeah, well, that's obvious, isn't it? I mean, they're not defensive, are they? They can only be dropped on people. The marked BT tank. What's a BT tank, Dennis? What does that stand for?
Well, that particular tank was... What happens with that one is that you can change the caterpillar track on it really quick and then just transfer it to wheels. which means, you know, for a road, I think at that time, even at that time, it could go 100 miles an hour, believe it or not, 100 kilometres an hour. And so, consequently, Russia hasn't got any highways with any concrete. So, but Europe has. So, 2 and 2 make 4, yeah?
So they had these tanks, and they were built with Caterpillar tracks that could be stripped off and replaced with wheels so that they could go up the German autobahns, basically.
Well, that's one tank. They also had another tank, forget the name of the one, but it's a similar thing to TK type of thing, which flew. Okay? So when it landed...
A flying tank.
I know it sounds ridiculous, but I've seen the diagrams of it. When it landed, right, you take the wings and you take the tail off, and it's immediately ready for action.
Bizarre. It'd have to be a fairly lightweight tank to fly, wouldn't it? I'm guessing.
Yeah, I suppose it would, yeah. But it's a fact.
Crazy stuff.
In fact, people who deny it normally say, oh, that didn't come into production until later. You know, if they're denying that it's weren't a defensive, that this were a defensive army.
Well, I remember. I remember in Greatest Story Never Told, you've just got these pictures of the railway, and there's just tank after tank after tank after tank that's, you know, just travelling along.
Yeah.
So they did have records of this.
Well, Hitler actually said when they went into Ukraine, they found some factories where workers used to just work 24 hours a day, sleep there in pitiful conditions just to get all these armaments out. He couldn't believe the number of tanks they had. Germany had, something like over 3,500 tanks, they made in 6 months in Russia.
Whoa. So it was the biggest... Wasn't it the largest amount of tanks ever, or something like that?
Yeah, no, without a doubt.
Well, also this week, or last week, it's just the right time for you to be working on this and bringing it out, because the threat of Bolshevism was about to become a reality with Stalin's planned invasion of Europe to take place on the 6th of July, 1941. So last week was the anniversary of Hitler saving Western Europe from communism.
Yeah, you're quite right. In fact, I can remember putting a video up in the early days, just a short little music video, and at the end, I think it's on the trailer, actually, of First Story Never Told, where it says, and Hitler saved Europe. And I remember somebody put a comment, oh, you mean saved Europe? Well, that's what I mean by saving Europe.
Well, you just don't hear about it, do you? But that, if it wasn't for Hitler, then Western Europe would have been the same as Eastern Europe, if it wasn't for him going in there. Yeah.
I think that was the plan, because obviously the bankers gave the okay for Stalin to invade, and they would have, with the size of that army, Germans were all right attacking, but it wasn't particularly a defensive army either. It was a quick blitzkrieg. So, you know, the longer the war went on, it was tougher for the Germans. But this army, what was coming into Europe, would have just obliterated it.
So really, you know, there should be some kind of, you know, commemoration of this. I mean, the only people that really commemorate Hitler's battle against the Soviets are really, you know, the Baltic states, and how they were protected by the SS and the legionaries. But that's the only place that really remembers it. And yet it was the whole of Western Europe that was protected, really. Not just...
even France, because at that time, if you remember, because I'm saying the Masonic countries like Britain and America and the Soviet Union and France, you know, these were all one big empire. But if you remember, France had fallen then to Germany. So that machine of Stalin's would have come right through, right up to, you know, up to the British Channel. I don't think it had gone any further, because the boss is in London. But that's why Hitler was kind of implying he was looking at a British invasion, trying to fool Stalin into thinking that, you know, let him wait to fight Britain and then, you know, they'll come in and annihilate what's left.
That's when the flying tanks would have come in, wouldn't it? Invading Britain. Or would they have had floating ones, maybe? Submarine tanks. Continuing, Adolf Hitler had secretly united all races and religions under the swastika, the cross of all religions, the eternal and universal Aryan cross, which existed even before the cross of Christ, but was symbolic and prophetic of the cross of Christ. I think that's really quite an important point to make. You know, a lot of pagans will say, oh, yes, well, the cross has been around for a long time before the crucifix and the Christians used it. But it was a prefigure of that fact. I mean, why would the cross be important to us? I mean, it was pointing the way to the crucifixion and Christ being crucified on that cross. So, it's saying that is the central point, was Christ being crucified. And, you know, if that was like a loud noise, and a loud noise was echoing, that it's echoing through time and before that point and onwards from that point. You were saying, you know, it's an eternal symbol, the Arian cross. And not just the swastika, just, you know, the cross as well. The swastika is a form of cross. And it's always been an Arian symbol as well. It was white people that used that. So even if it's in non-white countries now that you find remains of it, it shows that there were originally white people there. It's an Arian symbol. I mean,
that actually came from a comment, and I just thought it was just a beautiful comment. I said, I've got to use this, you know, because it was actually spot on, you know what I mean?
Well, yeah, it sums it up really, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Continuing, it links to the sun and the element of light, the purest and truest monotheism of all times, as it was not the sun per se that the ancient Arian people worshipped, but the one God through the sun at daytime and through the fire at night. I think, again, this is something that people miss as well. When they look at this sun worship, they think people were worshipping the sun. Well, no, that was the Aztecs and, you know, the third world. Yeah, you're people that were cannibalizing people. But when we looked at the symbol of the sun, it was the symbol for what it was for. Not actually worshipping the sun itself, but the sun as in, well, the sun, you know, it gives life to us. Therefore, it's a representative of God who gives life to us. I mean, it's not the sun itself. I mean, you can't just put the sunlight on a dead body and it comes back to life. You know, there is something else. The sun is, you know, it's like a copy of whatever it is that actually gives us life and gives life to our spirit. So it's a symbol for it.
You know, the reason that I've used the swastika, and obviously, you know, we're talking about the real depth of it, is that the nations and the religions that he welded together were all under the swastika, the banner of the swastika, because even though it's not in this particular video, it shows a news report of when even the Mufti down in Palestine called for a jihad to join, these are the words, to join the holy war, right? Because I've always said it was a holy war, to join the holy war under the swastika.
Okay, it's a good choice, isn't it? I mean, the Muslims probably would have been offended if it had been, you know, an actual crucifix there. But a cross, a swastika, is not going to be so offensive to Muslims. It's not going to be so offensive to the Japanese because they've got traces of the swastika in their own countries, but that's because white people were there before them. And that's the reason for it. I mean, the Hindus use it as well a lot.
That's right. Well, Jews, I think Jews have one, but I don't think they use it that often.
Don't they use it up very much anymore? Well, the swastika was banned after World War II as the secret societies returned to Europe to continue their quest in building a world without God. And they weren't just banning, you know, a Nazi symbol. They were banning the earliest symbol that we have that was left by the white race.
Yeah. It's a charm. Powerful charm and a good charm for the white race, which they don't really want, as you know.
Well, it symbolises movement, doesn't it? It seems to me that it symbolises the evolution of everything from a spot or from a point. And, you know, it can spread out in four different ways, upwards, downwards, left, right. And it's got movement there as if it's continually moving, which life is. It's a symbol for life.
Can I just say something, right? When in the U.S. Story Never Told, they actually say that Hitler designed that as a banner for National Socialism because they didn't have a flag, like, you know, the hammer and sickle that the Russians had there. When I was watching the video, I can remember a part in the film, I don't know if you can remember it or not, where Hitler's seen to be handing out leaflets, his street campaign in the real early days of National Socialism. Well, I freeze framed it and I blew it up And it actually says on the piece of paper, these leaflets, they were flyers, they were handing out, will Germany be Jewish or Christian? Now, you know, a lot of, not the greatest film in the world, that, but a lot of facts in that film I used because it was so factual. And that was an example of the how deep their research was.
Well, he also, you know, according to your documentary, I mean, he wanted to use that on the red and on the white black background. He wanted something that was immediate and that was like the opposite of the hammer and sickle.
Yep.
Which it is, isn't it? I mean, it's a Christian symbol to Christians, and it's a symbol of purity to these other races. But purity against impurity. Perfectly.
In fact, I think something on the lines that he wanted to strike fear into the communists. Because you know yourself, you know the problems that the National Socialists had after World War One up to this point, where, you know, they were getting killed, shot on the doorstep, and these people were escaping into Russia. So, you know, there was a bloody civil war going on, and he wanted to drive some fear into them, and that certainly did that trick.
Well, it's like garlic to a vampire to the Jews, isn't it?
Exactly.
Well, with Stalin in denial, the Axis forces annihilated his armies in the first weeks of Operation Barbarossa, which was named after one of the earlier Holy Roman Emperors. So let's have a look at Barbarossa. You know, there may be something about him, and this is the reason why his name was chosen for Operation Barbarossa. He was Frederick I, also known as Frederick Barbarossa. He was the Holy Roman Emperor from 2nd of January 1155 until his death, and he was named Barbarossa by the northern Italian cities, which he attempted to rule. Barbarossa means red beard in Italian. In German, he was known as Kaiser Rotbart, which has the same meaning. Before his imperial election, Frederick was by inheritance Duke of Swabia, 1147 to 1152, as Frederick III. He was the son of Duke Frederick Iloff of the Hohenstaufen dynasty, and Judith, daughter of Henry IX, Duke of Bavaria, from the rival House of Welf. Frederick, therefore, descended from the two leading families in Germany, making him an acceptable choice for the empire's prince electors. So he was a uniter. He was able to unite the different peoples in Germany because he came from these two different families. Historians consider him among the Holy Roman Empire's greatest medieval emperors. He combined qualities that made him appear almost superhuman to his contemporaries. His longevity, his ambition, his extraordinary skills at organization, his battlefield acumen, and his political perspicuity. His contributions to Central European society and culture included the re-establishment of the Corpus Juris Civilis, or the Roman rule of law, which counterbalanced the papal power that dominated the German states since the conclusion of the investiture controversy. Frederick died in 1190 in Asia Minor while leading an army in the Third Crusade. Well, I would suggest that that's fairly similar to Hitler himself, isn't it? I mean, his huge contribution to culture, and he separated the church from the state, counterbalanced the papal power, but yet at the same time was, you know, a staunch Christian and was there leading an army in the Third Crusade and was a great fighter and great ambition, extraordinary skills. And he sounds like an interesting character, like somebody, you know, I'd like to find out more about if he appeared almost superhuman to his contemporaries.
Well, I linked it because of this. We did a series a couple of weeks ago, didn't we, about the Holy Roman Empire and Hitler, the Third Reich being the Holy Roman Empire. So when he's calling Operation Barbarossa, is it a surprise?
Well, maybe we should look more into Barbarossa, actually, and maybe do something on him in one of the coming weeks.
Yeah.
It's always interesting to find out about our ancestors. Well, America would enter the war in January 1942, but the following newspaper headlines shows just how desperate Roosevelt was in 1941 to save Stalin, the mass killer. So do you want to explain what some of these headlines are referring to, Dennis? We've got 200 US warships out radar spotting. What was happening there, do you know?
Yeah, well, the thing was that America's supposed to be neutral. And if I suppose if the Congress found out that Roosevelt was intending to go to war all the time and they had the proof, then it would be in hot water. But he managed to get away with it, and these are just the things that he got up to. So right from, you know, all the way through 1941, we know he's trying to get into the war. We know about the Pearl Harbor and you know, the crack the Japanese code. And this is just showing his desperation, because all this time, obviously, you know, Germany's zooming in on Moscow, and Stalin's having to run things from a train, so they say. He's probably just catching the train to get out of the place. But, yeah, so, you know, and these are just a few headlines that I chose, which were shown in England. This is a Daily Express. So the Americans wouldn't have seen this, but certainly the English would have done.
Yeah, I was going to say, they're British newspapers, aren't they? So
one British newspaper, and that's the Daily Express.
We've also got Russia will get all she has asked for. So what's that referring to? Hitler going in there?
Well, this is saying like Stalin's pleading for help. You know, I mean, it can't open a second front now because the American population don't want to go to war. But obviously Stalin's begging for help because they're getting, you know, it's getting to a point where it's going to, I think, get a breakdown on all accounts. You know, he was living in denial to start with. When he was told about Hitler's invasion, he weren't having it. But when his armies were starting to disappear, then, you know, this great big thug was obviously a coward.
And we've got US occupies Iceland to stop Hitler coup.
Yeah, this is a neutral America.
Neutral and occupying Iceland, you know, they have a go at Hitler for occupying countries to prevent being invaded.
Exactly.
America occupies Iceland, right over the other side of the world, to protect the Eskimos, I guess. Oh, no, that's Greenland,
isn't it? Well, no, I think it was to protect the seas up there. They didn't want Russia cutting off up there.
Roosevelt to arm all U.S. ships.
Yep.
So, what point did that happen? They're still not in the war.
Well, what he was trying to do is he's trying to bait Germany. And Hitler sent out orders to his officers to not take the bait, because we know why he's doing it. Because as soon as it kicks off, I mean, a little bit later on, there's a headline which says 200 Americans killed in a sunken vessel, which is obviously a false flag, because the subtitle is that Roosevelt's on the verge, but obviously they didn't come in. So unlike the Lithuania, that had worked once, but it didn't work then, obviously. And I think Hitler even warned them that if they interfered, they would get torpedoed, you know, butt out, in other words.
Well, there is a mention of that later on. US will now shoot first in Battle of the Atlantic. And then the next one, we're in, says America. So you've got that.
I think they were in at one point.
And then it says Roosevelt answers torpedo threats.
Yep.
So where it says we're in, says America, that was a false start. They weren't actually in the war then, but that shows you how much they were anticipating it, how keen they were to actually get involved.
Sorry. Yeah. Well, the thing is that he gets criticised, Hitler, right, for declaring war on America. People think, like, you know, that was a bad move because America's America. But once Japan had struck, Hitler knew they were trying to get into war. So as soon as they declare war on Japan, that's their gateway to Europe. That's all Roosevelt wanted, really, to get at Germany.
You got a little bit muffled there, Dennis. I don't know if it's how you're holding the phone.
Can you still hear me?
Yeah, yeah. That sounds better. That sounds a bit clearer. British tanks go on.
Basically, I was just saying that, you know, they wanted Japan to attack, which would then leave the door open to get in the war, but they weren't particularly that bothered about Japan. They wanted Germany.
British tanks and planes defending Moscow. So
that was a cracker.
Tanks and planes defending Moscow. So where's America now? America has got to join the war now?
No, that's land lease. America's supplying Britain and Soviet Union with weapons and finance to keep them in the war.
Right. Which we've only just managed to pay back now, I think, haven't we? The debts from the war? Or have they not actually been paid back?
Well, but people have to remember, right, that Stalin was well known to Churchill and to Roosevelt. They knew about the Ukraine. You know, they knew about the Polish officer massacres. But, you know, all this time, he's working for them anyway. You know, he's their boy.
Right. And that's going to change later on, as we find out. So then you got, so why did Stalin turn against his puppet masters in the West? And then you answer it. It has been clearly established that the Soviet Union served as a proxy nation for the US bankers via London before, during, and after World War II. Well, following the war, something happened that made Stalin turn against his Western puppet masters, becoming a renegade dictator, turning on the Soviet Jews he had once supported with anti-Semitic laws, which had carried the death sentence. So, what was happening here then, Dennis? I mean, we mentioned some of this earlier, didn't we? This purge that he had, that was really just a purge of leaders that he thought weren't loyal enough to him, and he got rid of them.
Well, apparently, in Berlin, they found 25 train carriages full of Masonic artifacts that the Germans had picked up from various countries. Holland, you know, Channel Islands, no doubt. You know, as he went through Europe, like, he shut down all the lodges, and obviously they took everything back. And this is like 25 carriage fulls, which the Russians came across and decided to ship back to Moscow. You're still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. I've just muted while I'm not talking. So all this is Masonic information. This is Masonic documents. This is stuff that the Germans have found in the Freemason temple. So why was it all shipped back to Moscow? Why was it all shipped to Moscow?
Well, that's it. You know, the thing is, you wanted to have a look at it, because this is Mason documents, not meant for anybody to see. Well, the Germans had grabbed. So he's took it back to Moscow. Now,
It was someone in there which he didn't like. So you think it was the Soviets that found all of this, these 25 train loads?
Yeah.
It was the Soviets that found it, right.
Well, it's from the documentary by Jura Lira, I think, who actually sourced that find.
So they found all this information and they took it back there. And one of the bits that was in it, and this is from the Jura Lira bit, is that Lenin represents Freemasonry, and Lenin was an agent for Freemasonry. Bolshevism was Freemasonry.
Always said it.
So do you think maybe Stalin wasn't a Freemason? He wasn't aware of that?
I think he was a bit Freemason, but I don't think he was aware of what was going on in Europe in the lodges. I think he's come across some of what he didn't like, and he's hit the roof.
Right. So, and then it was just after this that he starts getting involved in these purges and getting rid of people?
Well, I mean, if you look at history, you know, at some point, you know, there's a cooling between the Allies and Russia, and the Berlin Wall goes up and all that. I think all this stems from all this, where Stalin's now turned and thought, bollocks to this, you know. I'm out of Russia, and we'll do what we want to do.
Well, you certainly the Allies seem to turn against him after the war, whereas before then they would seem to have just put up with anything from him and covered things up.
They don't actually paint him as bad as Hitler, do they? But, you know, it's a close-run thing, isn't it? So there's obviously some, you know, they don't think Stalin was worth recording history as a good guy.
Up to that point, they were calling him Uncle Joe, weren't they? Uncle Joe Stalin. And
this is exactly what I'm trying to say. Something's happened. Now, don't get me wrong, you know, psychopath's a psychopath, but I do believe something's triggered him off. This Cold War thing has started. And he even goes on to explain even more, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, straight after that, the next bit you've got, the US bankers were clearly unhappy at the situation, to the point where, unknown to most people, US fighters attacked the Soviet Union, destroying over 100 planes, in 1950.
Exactly.
So can you tell us a bit more about that?
Sorry?
So can you tell us a bit more about that, Dennis, about this attack on the planes?
Well, it's like I said, Stalin's gone his own way now. He's seen someone I feel anyway that he doesn't like. He's starting his purges. Whatever he's doing, he's not taking any notice of the Allies. And the Allies, when he's doing that, means they've lost the Soviet Union. Because up to that point, you know, they knew they lost it to Hitler. Well, they're not going to be happy with Stalin being a renegade dictator. Obviously, you know, time's passed now. So, you know, we're talking 1950, 5 years since the end of the war. And so nothing's changed. So they've sent in fighter bombers to attack the Soviet Union. And they attacked with, like I said, fighter bombers to destroy 103 planes on 5 different airfields. And yet there was no retaliation.
I mean, that is an act of war, isn't it? They must have been certain that they weren't actually going to get a response from him.
Well, I mean, by that time, apparently they both had the atomic bomb. But, you know, I don't know exactly the situation. But certainly there was no retaliation from Russia. In fact, what happened after that, there was the plotting to get rid of Stalin, which 3 years later, I think they did.
Yeah, and then you've got some more information about that, about how it was MI6 that got rid of him. And what you've got here, you've got when Stalin died in 1953, it was rumoured he had been poisoned. And according to archives opened when the Soviet Union fell, the KGB files confirm that this was so. Can you tell us a bit more about that? I mean, who was it that ordered this? Because I thought he was the guy in charge, you know, of the Soviet Union.
Well, what happened was there was a number of people around Stalin, because he obviously had his own course, he trusted guys. And a lot of them actually got killed for various reasons. So he was weakened by this point. And there was inside, obviously, there's insiders there working for the West. Khrushchev is believed to be one of them. And there's a couple of others. Molotov is another one. And there's one, can't remember his name, but he made sure that Stalin didn't get any medical treatment after he was poisoned. So, you know, it was like a day later until they actually saw to him at all. So this, according to the KGB archives, yes, he was poisoned. You know, they're not denying that. So the question then was, who poisoned him? Or who gave the word? Now, what the archives are saying, they're saying that they've got, the West weren't happy with Churchill. After the war, he lost the election. He wasn't honoured at all. He just went into oblivion. When he came back, 3 weeks after Stalin died, he was honoured with the Order of the Garter. So what they're saying is that this is like a second chance for Churchill, where he came back into politics and it was MI5 on Churchill's word to wrong a mistake what he had made during the war. What the elite weren't happy with. That was Stalin, a renegade dictator, now getting after Europe.
So what do you think Churchill did that was wrong during the war? What do you think it was that caused him to fall out of favour then? What was supposed to happen that didn't?
Well, like I said, you know, when check Poland, for instance. When he said to Poland, don't attack Germany, we'll back you up. And then all of a sudden, Germany attacks, and then Soviet Union attacked a couple of weeks later, you know, and don't get any, you know, problems at all with Churchill. That's because Churchill knew, because he's telling his guy, Rothschild's guy, whatever, bankers are in on it. So they know what Stalin's doing, you know, because half the time he's been told what to do. So when he gets to this point, at the end of the war, when he's gone off renegade, that means all the countries, not only the Soviet Union now, is lost to the bankers, but all the countries that the Soviet Union took over, Hungary, Romania, Stalin will rule all them for this 5 years up to 1950, because he's turned. And so now, obviously, they look at Churchill and he's carried the can. So now, when he's come back, he's got the second chance, he wins the election, comes out to semi-retirement, whatever it is, you know, to right the wrong. You can right the wrong with Stuart Shull, and nothing, you know, you go down in distribution and you're well looked after. What the KGB are saying is the MI5, MI6, whatever, were involved in the poisoning of Stalin on the nod from Churchill.
Right, so you got the link there. Channel, with
fine.
MI5.
You know, a big shout.
MI6,
doesn't surprise me. Well, I will not surprise me. I mean, you were a killer anyway with Churchill. You know you were.
He was a devil. Devil in human skin. But there's another allegation that you're making as well, the idea that Germany and the Soviet Union were supposed to sort of cancel each other out. Is that what you're saying? They were supposed to, you know, go to war against one another and destroy one another rather than, you know, Churchill losing the British Empire. It was supposed to be the Soviet Union and Germany cancelling each other out and then a one world order being formed after that. Is that sort of what you were saying here as well?
Well, yeah, but I don't believe they lost the empire. A simple reason for that. I do think that is a scam. When you've got a Rothschild central bank in all them countries, what they're supposed to have lost, they haven't lost nothing. Control them countries anyway.
So you think Stalin was supposed to lose a lot more than he did, and then he went renegade when he was fighting against Germany?
Well, no, I just think that at the end of the war, Stalin washed his hands of the Allies. He stopped taking orders, in other words, bollocks to them. And that means that they then lost what they gave Stalin. But they only gave it to Stalin because he's their proxy. Really, Hungary is in the hands of the US bankers. But it isn't while Stalin's on a renegade trip. And now the thing is, you know, we've got to carry the can for that. And Potsdam and Roosevelt and Churchill and all this kind of carry on. They divided up Europe. He even wrote down Poland on a piece of paper. Well, he would do because he doesn't need to be official because he's his boy. He's old normally, Stalin. Well, not anymore. This all makes sense to me.
Yeah, because you got an interview with this Russian guy, and he's saying that you know, Germany and the Soviet Union were supposed to obliterate each other, wipe each other out, and that was the plan.
Yeah.
Maybe that isn't what happened. The Soviet Union ended up winning and Stalin ended up taking all those countries in Eastern Europe. And that was never part of the plan. And then Stalin turned renegade afterwards. And when what was supposed to happen is that, the Soviet Union was supposed to get flattened by Germany and Germany was supposed to get flattened by the Soviet Union. But instead, Stalin ended up taking all these other countries. That was the bit that wasn't part of the plan. I think that's what this Russian guy is saying that you've got in there at the end. Is that right?
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah, but it's everything that I've been saying. I mean, it's obvious, Ben. If I fund the Russian Revolution to 60 million, which is probably worth, you know, 300 million billion today, and my lads win that revolution, I'm going to own Russia, not the guys who fought the revolution. I'll pay them good money, but the country will belong to me if I funded it.
That's the same thing that happened with Gaddafi and happened with, I forget his name, the guy from Iraq as well, wasn't it?
Yeah. These are all Bolshevik wars. These are Bolshevik wars. Because what happened when the Soviet Union fell, a lot of these people went to America, and some were already in America, as Patton found out, right? Didn't know how deep that went, but it went deep. So what they're doing to Iraq and Syria is exactly what they did to the Soviet Union, or to Russia, should I say, to White Russia. And then they tried to do it to Germany. They did it with France earlier. They tried it with Spain. Tried it with Mexico. These are just continuations. These revolutions, they call it Arab Spring. Really, it's a Bolshevik revolution. And the reason I said Bolshevik is because the neocons and Bush and all them, they're all Trotskyites. As I said, in communism by the back door.
Well, it's always a revolt of the underman,
well,
isn't it?
Higher now, when you look at it that way.
It's always the revolt of the underman. It's always the underclass. It's always the lowest IQ members of society that are encouraged to rampage and riot commit as many crimes as they like. They won't end up ever being prosecuted. They can take whatever they like and just destabilize the whole country. And then you can put in another power base.
Dad, this was an interesting thing this week, what happened. When Croatia beat Russia, one of the players dedicated that victory to the Ukraine. Now, the reason he did that was because when the fighting was going down in the Ukraine, when, you know, Crimea voted to stay with Russia, but they were still fighting inside the Ukraine. Some say Russian soldiers were down there, although not in marked uniforms. People from Croatia who'd been fighting in World War II have not forgotten what the Russians have done. And even though they're not the communists they once were, the Bolsheviks, they still have a hatred for Russia. And so they were fighting in the Ukraine, believe it or not, backed by Soros, which, you know, he'll use anyone and anybody to get to his terms. And so when this Croatian player dedicated the victory against Russia, every time he touched the ball against England, he got booed. That's why he did it, because of the hatred for the Russians to what communism did down in the Balkans.
There's a lot of confusion that goes on there, isn't there? I mean, you've got America that's backing people in Ukraine, and yet they're supposedly neo-Nazis. But it's just because they're going against Russia. So TJ in the chat room is saying Domagoj Vida was that player.
Yeah.
I think there's something to do with a symbol as well, wasn't there? Wasn't somebody doing a two-eagle symbol or something that was a symbol of Croatia or something? Some Croatian player that was playing for another team or something. I forget what it was. I don't really follow the football, but it was something about a symbol.
He got banned, I think. Another thing that happened not too long ago in Croatia, I don't know if you remember or not, but they had a game on television. I think England must have been playing somewhere in Croatia. And somebody overnight had put some kind of acid on the pitch in the shape of a swastika. And they had to work overnight to try and get rid of it. We could still see it while the football was going on, the swastika in the middle of the pitch. Still feeling down there, air feelings.
I bet. Well, moving on to the last little bit on the video, and you've got some information on Patton. And you've got a bit of film. What's this film taken from? Because it's obviously a dramatisation of something, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the book, actually, what the guy talks about at the end is Target Patton, which is goes into great detail of how he was assassinated. And I put these scenes in of the film as well. And it shows when Patton walks into the room, obviously the boss is Eisenhower. And Eisenhower pulls him up on a couple of things. He doesn't like the fact that he's, saying to the SS officers, it's okay, you can train and all this, you know, makes you feel better. And he's furious, he's Eisenhower. He says, you don't do that with Nazis, in his book, because he hates Germans. And then he puts him in charge of Bavaria, and he still kept Nazis on. And Patton said, yeah, but, you know, this is one of the first parts of Germany which couldn't be back on its feet. You don't treat Nazis, you get rid of them, chaff, I think, because obviously, you know, in the back of his mind, he's got like death camps. So I just put it in because it's just an unusual to see it, you know what I mean? You can see where Patton were coming from. In fact, he said to me at one point, Eisenhower, I don't believe this is true, but I have heard that you get these SS officers and SS soldiers fighting fit so you can go and fight the Soviet Union. I said, I wouldn't say that, no, but I wouldn't mind having to go up these. You know, to be honest, Patton was thinking, and you know what he wrote to his letters to his wife, that, you know, he realised far too late that, you know, Russian communism is going to be taking over America. But he didn't know, he already had, sublimely.
Yeah, one bit I also noticed is that they've got him saying, oh, he's Anglo-Saxon blood or something. They're obviously trying to paint Patton in a bad light. Well, yeah, they're trying to paint him in a bad light. And, you know, exactly. So they're linking Anglo-Saxon with pro-Nazi, basically.
Yeah, but what Patton was saying that, you know, I'm an Anglo-Saxon and I believe that if someone's innocent till proven guilty, you know, he was on about these war crimes or whatever, right? And which is what Anglo-Saxons do, you know, they're fair. But as they weren't having none of that now.
Well, it also, you know, it also says there at the end that he was giving a press conference on the day that he died, which shows that he was quite healthy. It says that he was quite healthy, doesn't it? If he was giving press conferences.
That's right. Yeah.
And there's no autopsy report, no information on it. Everything's been scrubbed. What happened there, do you know? Well, what do you think happened there?
Well, what from what I can gather, he had a minor car accident. But what they're saying is that they had an assassin who took a shot at him with some kind of weapon, bullet, which that's what broke his neck. When he was taken to hospital, he had these certain things on him, which was the worst thing he could put on him. Because apparently a doctor walked in and said, "What the hell's going on here? You don't do this with a person who, you know, broke his neck." And so he had to take all this stuff off him, and he started to recover. And that's when he had that press conference on the day. He was having the crack with the nurses and everything. He was looking forward to going on, you know. But further into the conversation of the boot, they say that, you know, there was no autopsy. It was all covered up. And we leave people.
You've gone silent there, Dennis. I think maybe your phone's running a bit low on the batteries or whatever. So he was coming back to life after the assassination attempt, and then he just suddenly died in the hospital after recovering.
Yeah, that's right. I'm trying to plug my lead in here. Nothing else. Hello.
That's it. I'm still here. Well, we've come to the end anyway, Dennis. But yeah, if you just want to add a little bit more, then if you've got something else to say.
Sorry, what's that? I didn't catch that last bit.
I'm saying we're just coming to the end here now anyway, Dennis. So,
If
you've covered it all there.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting episode.
Definitely, you know, I mean, I wasn't expecting that at the end. That's, you know, not a cliffhanger, but, you know, a sudden plot twist in the series, as it were. And definitely something that, you know, to look into some more, really, isn't it? You know, I will eventually get to read this book about Stalin, which gives a different view of it. Because I know a lot of the Russians do look up to him, even though he was, you know, such
an evil man. Well, and some people try to tell me he was a good guy, but I can't call someone who massacred that many Christians, priests and everybody else, a good guy. I can't do that. You know, I don't care if they say we're a nationalist at heart or whatever.
No, I think it's just the fact that he built an empire. I think that's, you know, that's what they look up to him for. Anyway, we've reached the end of the podcast, Dennis. Thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you very much.
Yeah, hopefully we'll get that sorted. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll get that sorted by next week, hopefully. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. Don't forget, we do require donations to keep the radio station going, and you will find a Bitcoin wallet at the bottom of every article and in the sidebar. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next Friday with more Truthful Out Radio for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you. Tuned in to